Hello and welcome to the American Magazine Podcast. I'm joined this week by Professor Charles Camosi, who's the Assistant Professor of Christian Ethics at Fordham University. Welcome, Charlie.
Thanks, Tim.
First, I want to tell you we have a sponsor for this podcast, which is the first time we have one, and it's brought to you by St. Bonaventure University, which will be holding a special conference on the legacy of Thomas Merton called Coming Home and Going Forth, Merton as Mirror and Model, and that'll be held from June 19th through 22nd, and you can find out more at sbu.edu/Merton. Well, Charlie, thanks again for coming in. We wanted to talk to you about a provocative book that you have, For Love of Animals, Christian Ethics, Consistent Action, which looks at vegetarianism and what Christians can bring to that discussion. So maybe we can begin by saying, you know, what does Christianity teach about our responsibility to animals?
The first thing I want to say about that before jumping into any conclusions about vegetarianism or what we should or shouldn't be eating is just, at a very basic level, what are animals and what should our relationships to animals be, right? And it's actually pretty clear. If you just open the Bible and look at Genesis 1, God creates animals good, period, full stop, without any reference to human beings. And in Genesis 2, you flip the page, you see that God brings the animals to Adam because it is not good that man should be alone. Now, of course, no suitable partner, quote-unquote, was found for Adam among the animals. But it's interesting to note that the reason why the animals were brought to Adam by God is because it is not good humanity should be alone. And I think those two fundamental truths just need to be thrown out there right away and say that is, for those that hold this to be indicative of God's will, as just a very central starting point for how to think about animals. Animals are not tools. They're not things for us to use however we want. They have their own goodness and capability of flourishing apart from human beings.
Now, maybe we can delve just a little bit more into the Christian tradition. I mean, were there other theologians over time that kind of explored this issue a little deeper?
I wish there were more. some. So, for instance, Thomas Aquinas thought that all of creation again was part of the common good and was to flourish as God intended, and that human beings need to put their own desires, their own wants behind God's will for all of creation and to submit it to God's will for all of creation, especially when our wills are disordered with consumerism and selfishness and a desire to dominate and to be violent. Other Christian thinkers, especially in the early church, if you look at the fathers and their relationship to pagan Rome, the Romans, as you know, were very fond of their games, and they slaughtered huge numbers of animals in these games. And many of the fathers forbade Christians from attending these games, and not just the games where humans were slaughtered, but also the games where animals were slaughtered. Interestingly, at least for me, in the early church as well, the early church had to think about, well, are we a Jewish movement? Are we something other than a Jewish movement? What of the Jewish law are we going to keep? And something that I think was later read back as the Council of Jerusalem happened, where they tried to come to a compromise about, well, how much of the Jewish law are they going to keep? And they kept four provisions, three of which had to do with animals. So one of the provisions was we're going to keep the prohibition against eating meat that had been strangled. It seems pretty obvious what's at stake there. We're going to keep the prohibition against eating meat that had been sacrificed to idols. And if there's meat that's being sacrificed to idols today, I would argue it's the meat in our factory farms who are being sacrificed, the animals are being sacrificed to the idol of consumerism and profit-making. And then the one we often hear about, which is the meat that still had its lifeblood in it, the kosher prohibition. But I like to bring up that as a really interesting example, especially the meat sacrificed to idols, because of course nobody believes in Jupiter anymore, but we do have our idols, and definitely consumerism and profit would fall into that category.
Now, you've written about how if there's pushback on this notion about our responsibility to animals, from a scriptural perspective, it might come from Genesis and, the verse that says that humans have dominion over the animals of the land and the fish of the sea. Is that a misreading of that particular text?
Yeah, dominion is invoked in all sorts of ways that are problematic. We've talked at length in theological circles for decades now about how it's misinvoked when it comes to our concern for ecological health and environmental health. But I think we need to start really thinking about this question with regard to non-human animals. Dominion does not mean that we can simply do whatever we want and exert our power and will and violence to use animals, again, as mere tools for whatever we want. Dominion is, our dominion is an extension of God's dominion. And the God revealed by Jesus Christ, of course, is a non-violent God who asks us to care about the most vulnerable, who asks us to care about the marginalized, who asks us to resist consumerism, who asks us to care about the flourishing of all of God's creation. And if it's that kind of dominion that we're called to, and I believe it is, then that dominion is not about us exerting power. It's about protecting creation. It's about being a caretaker, about being a good steward. And that fundamental shift in how to think about dominion, I think, is a direction we're slowly but surely heading toward.
Now, in terms of, you know, the way we consume meat now and the, you know, the attitudes that existed back then, you know, what is it? Was it the Industrial Revolution that got us to this point where, you know, we have these these slaughterhouses and, you know, this huge production of meat in these ways?
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, we shouldn't be glossing over the horrific ways we treated animals throughout all of human history. So from the beginning, and even before, arguably, humans had capacity for rational reflection even, or religion, human animals have been dominating non-human animals. I mean, pretty much ever since we were able to make tools and weapons, this was the history. But things took, as you suggest, a really serious turn with the advent of the Industrial Revolution. And now I think we're having another kind of super serious turn, if you will, with the advent of biotechnology. So factory farms were created where now 50 billion animals are slaughtered each year in factory farms all over the world, 50 billion with a B. And the horrific ways that they live and are slaughtered are problematic. But now you add to that biotechnology, where we're able to genetically alter these animals in ways that maximize profit for big, huge food corporations, it gets pretty scary really quickly. So, for instance, factory farms today are now genetically altering chickens so that they don't feel hungry when they eat. So they eat as much and as quickly as possible and get to as large a size as quickly as possible. And of course, this is done not because presumably they hate chickens, but because they want to maximize protein units per square foot in the factory farm. So yes, the Industrial Revolution and now the biotech revolution are really changing what was already a bad situation for animals for the worse.
Now, you've also written about how this, at least in our American culture, this has kind of been a politicized issue, like where vegetarianism perhaps is seen as kind of a East Coast or liberal value, and, you know, the people of the heartland push back against that. Although in other ways, you say it's more complicated. There are people writing in places like First Things and National Review from a more conservative standpoint, but saying that this is an issue we need to pay attention to as well.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I'm trying to make my career about is thinking beyond these, in my view, lazy categories of liberal and conservative. I just don't think, I mean, whether the issue is abortion or war or healthcare or animals, I just don't think these categories are very helpful. And here they're not helpful either. And you helpfully pointed to First Things and National Review and other conservative magazines and publications that are really starting to pay attention to this issue in a very serious way. And understandably so. I mean, one of the classic concerns of quote-unquote conservatives is for rural America and small-town America, which, of course, is driven by the small farm and has the backbone, at its backbone, the small farm. But these huge factory farms and the corporations which wield them have decimated the backbone of rural America. And so what we're not talking about when we talk about resisting factory farms are necessarily resisting hunting or other kinds of animal interaction that is so common or was so common in the heartland, but resisting the kind of consumer profit-driven practices of these big corporations and factory farms.
I wonder, maybe you can talk a bit about your own evolution on this issue. Is this something that you wrote a book about with Peter Singer, who's one of the leading intellectuals on this question, his book Animal Liberation. Did some of it come out of those conversations?
Yeah. Unfortunately, my own journey through the Catholic intellectual world didn't lead me to this question. We don't have a lot to say about this, unfortunately, or until very recently, we didn't have a lot to say about these questions. And so it was actually picking up Peter Singer's book called Practical Ethics, where he deals with a number of ethical issues. I picked it up to read him on abortion and infanticide, but for complicated reasons, I ended up reading the rest of the book. And I read the chapter on animals and was profoundly convicted of my own participating in what I consider to be a really serious structure of sin, factory farming. And his arguments all by themselves, I think, are good enough to dissuade us from participating in that. But then I did a deeper exploration of my own tradition on these questions and found rich resources that are just not really being explored, or again, until recently, not being explored. So Peter Singer's work brought me to the issue. But once I started reading scripture with new eyes and looking at the tradition with new eyes and looking at the theologians, especially the ecological theologians, some of those who are doing more work on all of creation, not just on humans, there are tremendous resources in my own tradition to bring to bear on this question as well.
The question of, like, animals and whether they're sentient, or even the question of the animals, whether they have a soul, are those things that come up in these discussions? Or is it enough to say that, to look to Genesis and say, you know, it is our duty to take care of them, and that's enough? That's enough of a call.
Well, I mean, on one hand, I think it's enough because Genesis, if we take Genesis seriously, it can change our orientation with regard to animals and help us think of them as something other than things and think of them as beings that have their own value. But when you think about, well, how precisely should we respect that value? What does this demand of us? I think what it demands of us is different if it's a mouse that we're talking about, or a chimpanzee, or a dolphin. And that does get us into those kinds of questions. So what are the lives like for a chimpanzee in captivity, or a pig in a medical research lab, or a chicken in a factory farm, or a mouse in a medical research lab? Complicated questions. We don't have, obviously, direct access to what it's like. In some ways, it's presumptuous of us to assume that we can have access to that. But I think if we don't ask those questions, we miss out on the proper way to relate to various different kinds of animals. We can learn some things. So self-awareness is an issue that I think is really important to talk about. If a being is self-aware, they're capable of knowing that they exist and wanting to continue to exist, right? And we have tests for self-awareness. So if a being recognizes herself in a mirror, for instance, that's good evidence that they're self-aware. They recognize, hey, that's me there. And we have evidence of animals recognizing themselves in a mirror. So the great apes all recognize themselves in mirrors. Elephants recognize themselves in mirrors. Dolphins and porpoises and certain whales recognize themselves in mirrors. Maybe others also have self-awareness, and we maybe shouldn't be too quick to dismiss them because we don't have proof. But at the very least, we seem to have proof that certain animals are self-aware, and that means we should take their moral status very, very seriously.
Now, in terms of Christianity and how it perhaps can bolster the movement towards vegetarianism, what are people in the Christian tradition saying? What is people in the Catholic Church saying?
Well, like I said, we haven't said enough, but it's starting to change. One thing that I get excited about when I think about Christians and specifically Catholics getting on board with this is that we have the institutional power to really make change in ways that other groups do not. So, for instance, our Archdiocese of Philadelphia recently went cage-free. All their eggs are cage-free. Now, wouldn't that be great if other dioceses, or even the conference, you know, the U.S. conference said Catholic institutions cannot participate in the factory farming of egg-laying hens, for instance. I think that would be great, and that would provide a real boost for more just and humane treatment of animals. Lent is coming up. We used to take our Lenten fasting much more seriously, and we didn't eat meat through all of Lent and every Friday outside of Lent. Maybe those would be things to bring back. And the theology is in some ways more hardcore than the philosophy that's been brought to bear. So if you really do take the idea seriously that God has commanded us to be good stewards of creation and to let his God's creation flourish, that is a really, really serious thing. And it's not just a utilitarian calculation. And so there are all sorts of good reasons, or reasons I would get excited about the Christian churches getting on board with this. Some of them are practical and institutional, and some of them are theological.
Well, we were just speaking earlier about Peter Singer, who in his book, Animal Liberation, saw religion as sort of the enemy in this movement, but has come around to the point where he thinks it can be an ally.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really, especially for those of us that study ethics, this is a really stunning 180 for him. I mean, his book, Animal Liberation, basically inaugurated the animal rights movement in the mid-70s, at least in the English-speaking Western world. And in that book, he blames the Christian sanctity of life ethic for why we treat animals so terribly. In part due to conversations that he and I have had, he's done a 180 on this and now considers Christianity to be an ally. And when I talk to him, I say, listen, you want this stuff to go mainstream. It's impossible, in the United States anyway, it's impossible for me to see a scenario where this goes mainstream, where the Christian churches are not on board.
Oh, you mentioned Pope Benedict. Yeah. He wrote about this. You said you could even see him as a member of the slow food movement.
Well, it was Pope Francis, actually.
Oh, it was Pope Francis.
Yeah,
okay.
But I have something to say about Pope Benedict, too. But Pope Francis, there was an LA Times story, I believe, about him being called by the founder of the slow food movement in Europe and saying that he was, or I think it was the other way around. I think he called him. And Pope Benedict, or Pope Francis, called him, and they had a very cordial conversation where Pope Francis revealed himself a supporter of the slow food movement. And some people might point yet again to this as some sort of new thing that Francis was doing, but Benedict the 16th was called the Green Pope and had very serious concerns for all of creation. And just before, he was well known for being an animal lover. For instance, there are stories of his insisting on taking stray cats from the streets of Rome into his Vatican home and being told he can't do that. I guess when he was younger, people would give him pets as gifts because he was just such an animal lover and known for being an animal lover. And there's a fascinating quote that actually PETA used in their advertisements. I actually have it on my door in my office at Fordham. It's got a big this ad has a big picture of Benedict with a quote from just before he became Pope, when he was Cardinal Ratzinger, saying that essentially factory farming does not cohere with gospel values. And he talks about, you know, particularly the plight of hens and geese in factory farms. And that's a powerful quote coming from somebody who's about to become Pope. Francis is about to write an encyclical on ecological issues, and he's going to combine, you know, more typical ecological issues with something he calls human ecology. And in my view, anyway, I think there's a good chance it's going to focus on the destructive nature that consumerism has, both on human ecology, on our virtue as humans, and on the broader ecological world, including non-human animals. And there's no better example of that than factory farming, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, you mentioned consumerism. That seems to be something where Peter Singer and Pope Francis have some common ground, as something to push back against.
Absolutely. It doesn't get a lot of play because utilitarianism, and specifically Peter Singer's utilitarianism, is often thought to be sort of like, you know, the diametrically opposed enemy of all things good and holy, especially Christian things good and holy. But when it comes to concern for the poor and a suspicion of consumerism, boy, oh boy, there's really no two stronger traditions of thought criticizing that than Catholic social teaching and utilitarianism.
Well, maybe we can talk briefly. I mean, is there a connection there, since Pope Francis is so focused on the poor and working with the poor? I mean, in terms of, certainly you talked about the public health issues that some of these practices, eating too much meat, pose, especially for people from poor backgrounds. I mean, is that one way that this issue impacts them?
Yeah, I mean, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because the animal suffering issue is essential, and we ought to talk about that a lot. But factory farms are detrimental in so many other ways. For instance, as a contributor to climate change, factory farms are are worse than all the cars, all the planes, all the trucks in the world combined. These mountains of feces that are created by factory farms put all this methane into the atmosphere, and it's just horrible for the ecological health of our planet. And then a lot of these workers are exploited in the factory farms, as you might imagine. And many of them, as you also might imagine, are undocumented workers, because who wants to do these jobs other than those that are in these kinds of desperate situations? And then if we're going to look at economic efficiency and feeding the globe, this just isn't the way to go. If you're going to take an acre of land and you're going to think about economic efficiency for getting calories out of that acre of land, it makes no sense to grow crops and then feed those crops to animals who have a lot of the energy go away in their own, obviously, living their lives, and then eat part of the animals, right? It's just so inefficient. It'd be much more efficient to simply eat the vegetables. And then that doesn't even get into the health issues, which you mentioned. So are these animals and factory farms are doused with antibiotics? We're on the verge, as I believe Frontline, PBS's Frontline, is about to do a major expose on how serious the creation of drug-resistant bacteria and superbugs are as a result of our overuse of antibiotics. Over half of our use of antibiotics are on non-human animals in these factory farms. And then, of course, you know, if somebody's diagnosed with cancer, one of the first things they tell them is to stop eating red meat. I could go on here, but it's important to underscore this idea that our participation in factory farms not only contributes to the detriment of animals, but also of humans.
And maybe we could talk briefly. I was intrigued by that sanctity of life argument. You know, if somebody were to say, well, you know, we only have so many resources here, we need to focus them on the seamless garment and, you know, protecting the unborn through fighting the death penalty, can the plight of animals be on that seamless garment spectrum? Or some people may say that's a bridge too far.
Yeah, I mean, that's maybe one of the more controversial claims I make in the book, but I'm willing to defend it. I think this is a seamless garment issue, especially if you, at some point I want to write a book thinking about the consistent ethic of life for a new century, a new generation, the generation past Bernadine. And thinking about that, I want to dial it back to, like, well, what are the core principles that undergird the consistent ethic? What are they? And I think they're nonviolence. They're a concern for the vulnerable, a suspicion of consumerism. And if we are not what Peter Singer calls speciesist, that we randomly include some species and exclude others, but include all species in our concern for nonviolence, in our concern for consumerism, in our concern for those on the margins, individuals whose dignity and worth is inconvenient for those in power. I think you absolutely have to include concern for animals, and particularly for factory farming, in the consistent ethic. And some people, as you, in the subtext of your question, I think, some people say, well, what about just limitation of resources and we can't do everything? And that's true. So individuals can't do everything. We all have different gifts. We're all called to different ways of ministering. But that's not a reason not to think about them together. So, you know, one person cannot fight against abortion and the death penalty and euthanasia and war. They'd make themselves crazy and they wouldn't do a very good job at any of them. But that's not a reason not to include all of them in the same ethic. So certain people will be focusing on, you know, abortion. Others will be focusing on war. Others will be focusing on the death penalty. And some will be focusing on animals, or some might be focusing on more than one. But the logic of consistency, of linkage that Bernadine so famously came up with, and now Pope Francis is continuing, most certainly includes concern for animals, in my opinion.
And this seems to be something that, if you're trying to reach out to the next generation or listen to the next generation, this is something that young people are very engaged with, and that something that perhaps we can learn from them.
Yeah, I mean, it's only anecdotal, but my own experience giving talks and teaching classes definitely tracks with what you just said. I rarely get pushback from my 19-year-old freshman. I almost always get pushback from a 60-year-old colleague, right? And it's just my anecdotal experience, but I think probably others have a similar experience. But one struggle that we, young or old, are trying to overcome is the way that we most encounter and most often encounter animals today is when we eat them. We have a, especially as we move to the cities, become a more urbanized culture, we just don't have the kind of experiences, especially on the coast, but increasingly in the South and in the Midwest. We increasingly meat simply shows up on our plate without any sense of how it got there. In fact, we don't even call it by the name. We say it's pork rather than pig, right? Or, you know, it's beef rather than cow. And we need to reconnect in general, I think, to the systems of production, to how things come to us. I mean, we can now simply press literally one button on our computer screen and hours later Amazon shows up with a package. But so in general, I think we need to reconnect with the means of production, how things come to us. But I think we need to do it in particular with regard to our food and in particular with regard to our meat.
Now, final question. You know, somebody's listening to this podcast, maybe hasn't considered this issue seriously, but is a Catholic and is intrigued. Are there simple ways you can get started? I mean, you mentioned the cage-free eggs is something that the Archdiocese of Philadelphia is doing. I mean, are there small steps that if somebody's not quite ready to make the full leap that they can do?
Yeah, and I'm not here to hold myself up as some sort of like a perfectly consistent holy person with this. I'm 38 now. When I was 30, I decided that I would try to be a vegetarian who ate fish, a pescatarian. And I've managed to do that for a while. I think in a year or two, I'm going to try to go vegan. But it's been a slow process for me. I was convinced of these arguments when I was 24. It took till I was 30 to really sort of be serious about it. And I'm not as serious as I should be now. But there are small things you can do. And like, I think returning to the tradition of not eating meat on every Friday is a good one. What about giving up meat for Lent? That's coming up soon. You could try it out. The Humane Society of the United States has a strategy, a PR strategy, in which they suggest eating less meat, not giving it up. So if you want to go the Friday route, and now there's a more secular tradition of something called Meatless Mondays, which many are starting to invoke. So if 2 days a week you don't eat meat, that's something significant. Putting the economic pressure back on the factory farms by eating less meat, by eating meat from locally raised farms, from, again, reconnecting to the means of production. These are all ways, I think, that slowly but surely we can push the energy in a different direction from the kind of cruelty and consumerism that rules the day right now.
Well, again, the book is For Love of Animals, Christian Ethics, Consistent Action, and we want to thank Charles Camosi for joining us today.
Thank you, Tim.